Encouraging usable designs for a better customer experience, this is Design Critique, Products for People, number 40, for January 27th, 2008. Time for another interview episode, recorded at User Interface 12 in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on November 7th, 2007. In this episode, I interview Kim Goodwin, Vice President and General Manager of Cooper, the people who brought you those great books, The Inmates Are Running the Asylum, and About Face. At User Interface 12, I attended two presentations by Kim. The first one was called Integrating Design in Your Organization, and the second was a full-day seminar called Essentials of Interaction Design. The interview runs about 15 minutes, after which I will return to read some email the show has received. As always, thank you for listening. Welcome to another episode of Design Critique, Products for People. This is Tim, and I'm at User Interface 12 with Kim Goodwin, Vice President and General Manager of Cooper. Hello, Kim.
Hi, Tim.
I have just attended two sessions from you. Yesterday, it was Integrating Design in Your Organization, and today you had a seminar called Essentials of Interaction Design, and that was all day, and I very much appreciate you being here after that session is over, talking to me and the rest of the listeners.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. Happy to do it.
Well, I'm delighted you're here, and I really enjoyed both presentations. And the first thing I'd like to talk about is when you said your piece about integrating design in an organization, you used a gardening metaphor. And you used things, phrases such as watering the seed and the greenhouse and other things like that.
Sure.
Could you explain that just a little bit for the listeners?
Well, I may be obsessed with gardening lately because I've been working on a landscape project, but I have learned over the years working with a variety of organizations that doing any sort of organizational change is a lot like gardening. It takes time and it takes patience. And I think that with integrating design, you have to start out by planting the seed. In other words, talking about design and the possibilities that you have with design. And then you have to raise it in a sheltered environment like a greenhouse by picking your pilot projects and so forth wisely so that design has a chance to succeed in small ways and build credibility before you try something very ambitious and have your fledgling effort die. I'm mixing my metaphors, but I think you get what I mean, where design at first is a very tender plant and it's easy to kill off, and it's really hard to get the organization started on design and give it a second chance if you fail.
You don't want an early frost with your project.
You could put it that way, yes.
And speaking of design, if our listeners at the moment haven't read Inmates Running the Asylum or About Face, could you explain when Cooper says design, what they mean by design?
It's everything from what should the product be to how exactly does it work. And our general approach starts with researching human needs, typically using ethnographic techniques, turning that into a set of personas, which are essentially expressions of human behavior patterns we've seen in our research, and using those combined with storytelling scenarios to drive the ultimate solution. Now, that ultimate solution could be a piece of software, it could be an intelligent device like a glucose meter or a cell phone or something like that, or it could be an environment or some other kind of service or system.
So, not just products, but also services.
Sure, absolutely.
Kim, one thing I've noticed throughout my consulting years and now being inside a place, there is an understanding that you need a user interface design because that's the front end of a product, but a lot of people aren't necessarily appreciating the difference between interaction design and user interface design. And while they go hand in hand, I think sometimes people confuse user interface design for really all you have to do for the front end. Could you just talk about interaction design and user interface design?
I think that over the years, some people have used user interface design, the term, in the way that we now use interaction design, so I think some of that confusion is natural. Even when you talk about interaction design, I think there are people who still see it as the front end. And what many companies are starting to learn is that the front end is your product from a user's point of view. Your brand is the behavior of your products and services, and not just what your logo looks like. And so they're realizing that the user's experience should be what is defining the product. We make a distinction between visual interface design and interaction design. They certainly overlap, but interaction design is focused on the behavior of the product. What does it do and how does it do it? Visual interface design we view as the expression of the behavior. So not just typefaces and colors, but also how do you indicate to a user what's the priority of things on the screen, which are the things that have affordances that say, hey, click me, I'm actually going to do something if you click on me. And the two need to be tightly integrated, but they are certainly different specialties.
One thing that my co-host Tom and I used to talk about, and well, I still talk about on this show, is the interface is the product, is the short little phrase we use a lot of times, because I think most end users and most products don't really care about what happens that they can't see. They only know if their goals are being achieved or not.
Right.
In a way that they would prefer to have them met.
Sure. And
so
I think that, you know, we have to be careful as designers how we say that, because it can certainly make other people feel like we're saying designers should rule the world. But and the technical implementation affects the interface. For example,
sure.
If you have a system that's very buggy or non-responsive, well, that can ruin the experience too. You know, so certainly the engineering and the marketing and everything else go hand in hand. But until you pay attention to that end user experience, you know, you're seriously neglecting most of what people think is the product.
Yes, and hanging out here at User Interface 12 this week, one thing I've been thinking is we need to revise our catchphrase into the interaction is the product, or perhaps just the experience is the product. And
yeah.
Leave it at that, because the interface is the product, much as I've been enjoying saying it. You don't want people to be confused with just the presentation, Larry, as they would call it.
Yeah, and the experience is, you know, how responsive is it? How reliable is it? The experience also includes how well supported is it? When you have a problem and you call customer service, what happens there?
That's all part of the experience of the product. Not necessarily a GUI, but it's an experience. It's an adjunct.
Yeah, and it's someone's experience of your brand.
Exactly.
And those negative experiences build up a lot easier than the positive experiences do. So it's much easier to tear down a brand than it is to build one.
Oh, it's much easier to criticize a design than it is to do your own and make it better. Everybody's
Isn't that
a critic,
always the case?
Right? That's the old thing, even in showbiz and everything else. I'm curious about some of the things you said yesterday in your integrating design presentation. If someone were to be the first person in an IT shop to be introducing some of these things, would you have any advice for them, just in a blue sky kind of way, like first year in, second year in, just to establish something that is perhaps moving from the under-the-radar stage to more of a formalized thing, and now that everybody knows you're here and you're doing these things for a whole department, how do you start that?
Sure. I think the first place to start is to realize that it's not plug and play. You know, you can't just plug a designer into a culture and expect that all of a sudden you're going to do design and live design in that company. I think it's important to realize that significant cultural change takes years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and your mention of year one, year two, year three, I think is headed in the right direction. It's not going to be instantaneous. I think that in the first little while you're there, it may be 6 months, it may be a year, the first thing any designer needs to do is demonstrate their value.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we can talk about how valuable design is, but people won't really start to believe it until they've experienced it. And once you've demonstrated your value, people will provide you with opportunities to add more value. So I would say focus on demonstrating the value first, and then start evangelizing design. You have to market yourself and sell your services internally as if you were an external consultant in many ways, because you're trying to convince people that you can help them. And you know, you have to do that in a way that isn't going to make them feel threatened, that isn't going to make them feel like you're judging them. You're just saying, hey, I have a different skill set and a different tool set to offer. You may find it valuable for these reasons. Here's what I've done over here. And develop allies. Make sure that other people are promoting you as well, because that's more powerful than you promoting yourself.
Definitely. I like what you said, Kim, there about having these allies and having these people who appreciate what's going on. What if you succeed to the point where people really are glad you're there and they all want you to help, but you are one person? What would you advise that person in an organization that hasn't had this kind of person before? Use them to the best for the first year, second year, without getting them so thin, as you said today, that maybe you just become a reactive usability voice rather than the co-designer, co-helper with these things.
Okay. If people get to the point where they really want you in all their projects, I would say first pat yourself on the back, because that's a huge achievement. and you have to celebrate the achievements along the way.
This is abundant thinking, right?
Right?
We're just saying, what if this happens?
And assuming that that you're in that position, I think you have to negotiate with your manager about how to be able to focus on just a small number of projects at a time. I think that trying to handle more than a couple of projects is going to spread you too thin. You're not going to be able to provide really significant value on multiple projects. Now, that doesn't mean they can't be short projects. They could be month-long projects. Mm-hmm. But you want to be able to make sure you don't have more than two or three things on your plate at a time. So try to negotiate that. If you need to support some other project that's in its last stages and you're just doing little bits and pieces, schedule some explicit time for that, but limit it so that you're spending 4 days a week on some other significant project. I think that if you have too many things going on, you're going to be in a position where you're not actually doing design. You're just reviewing design that the developers are doing, and that's not providing value. And that's, they may view that as helpful, but they may come to view you as the usability police and the rule enforcer and view
that's
you
a
as
a negative connotation.
Yes,
of
and they may view you as a critic rather than a creator, and that's very important.
Right. I've always enjoyed being co-creator, but you know, if you come in toward the end and just tell people there's a problem here, even if it's true, that's not necessarily a morale building exercise on a team, is it?
It's not seen as constructive. You know, you're not seen as a helper. You're seen as a roadblock at that point because, gosh darn, we're almost done. Now what's he telling us about? So,
One thing you've mentioned today is abundance thinking. And I wondered if you could just, I know we've already used it here, in fact, because you already have me using it, but if you could just talk about that for a couple sentences.
Sure. I think that in the business world, we're very accustomed to scarcity thinking and to assuming we don't have enough resources in one way or another, enough people, enough time. In engineering, you know, scarcity thinking is often about how much memory or bandwidth or processor power we have. And
right.
Some of it comes from back when, you know, 16K of memory was a lot, and you had to protect that wimpy little processor. And these days, computing power and bandwidth are so cheap, and storage is so cheap, that that's kind of silly. What abundance thinking is it says, look, start from a place where you have all the resources you could possibly want. Maybe in reality, you're not quite there, but it'll at least get you to a better idea, and it will let you set the bar higher and say, here's a goal that we want to hit. And you can maybe get 80% of the way there, whereas if you start with scarcity thinking and you set your target very low, well, you're not going to do any better than that because you're not being very ambitious to begin with.
So it's just like those old Air Force ads here in the United States, aim high. There's no point in aiming low.
Yeah, and a lot of companies aim low. And
it's almost a reflex, maybe.
It's a reflex. It's also a cultural thing. I think that in many companies, people are punished for failure. And innovation requires a certain amount of risk, and sometimes you will fail. That is a guarantee. And so if you're punished for failure, you're never going to try anything that might expose you to failure.
I like what you said yesterday when you said, expect to fail, just don't fail it the same way twice.
Yes.
Because then people justifiably should be very upset.
Right. Make mistakes, just don't make the same ones over and over. Yeah.
And everybody has good intentions, hopefully. We are here in the hotel in beautiful Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we have some various patrons running through the hall at the moment. Anyways,
you might just want to pause for a bit. I think you ought to use that one.
What?
Fire engine.
Thank you.
It's all right, it's a public space.
It's good to be enthusiastic.
I'm hot rod, all right.
Well, is there anything at the end of this interview you'd like to say about Cooper or other things you'll be doing in the future yourself? I know that you're writing a book. Can you talk about that?
I am writing a book. It's focused on the methods that we use at Cooper.
Okay.
Including everything from planning and conducting user research in a lot of detail to personas, scenarios, generating design concepts, how visual and industrial design interface with interaction design, to develop complete product solutions. And it's probably going to be about 700 pages. It's
excellent.
It's the detailed method book that we've been meaning to write at Cooper for years now, and finally have the time to write. And so it's going to take me a little while to get there, but I'm looking forward to having it out in the world.
Well, whenever that is, I will invite you to come back on the show to talk about its publication.
Because
we'd be delighted to hear about this book. I will look forward to it eagerly.
Great.
And I'm sure a lot of the listeners will, too.
And if you want to know more about what we're up to at Cooper in general, our URL is just cooper.com. And give us a look. Look at our design and training services. There's always something going on.
Well, Kim Goodwin, thank you so much for talking with me here at User Interface 12.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Take care.
All right, there you have it. I'd like to thank once more Kim Goodwin for consenting to be interviewed after a very long day. And I'd also like to thank User Interface Engineering for being the sponsor of this particular episode of Design Critique Products for People. They brought us to User Interface 12 to cover the conference. Now, time for some feedback. The first note I have here is from Brian. He says, loved the interview with Jerry McGovern. He's wonderful. He's referring to Design Critique episode 38 here. Loved the interview with Jerry. He's wonderful. I saw him at UI 11 in 06, and he was by far the best speaker. He's so engaging. So, a big thanks for getting him on the show. It's interesting to see his words drive behavior, quote-unquote, when you see some of our clients focus so much of their attention on colors, brand, and look and feel instead of doing a card sort. Arg. Love the show. Thanks again for all the hard work. And thank you, Brian. He does go on to say, I also love the style of your show, too. Music, intro, etc. It all works great for me. I also like the 45-minute format. Sometimes an hour seems too long. I don't know. I guess it all depends on the topic, too. Fatigue for me sets in somewhere around 45 to 60 minutes. What I like about Jerry is how he presents his information slash research. He has a better style than most, and it resonates well with people who aren't in the UX world. He's simply right on about task-based design, especially with intranets. When I was at my previous employer, it was a complete mess. Silo City. So that's from Brian. Thank you very much, Brian. And I appreciate hearing what you think of the time for the episodes as well. And here's another note from Eric, who had sent in the note we read in episode 39 in December. He says, Tim, I listened to episode 39 on the way to work today. Thanks for reading my email and addressing all parts fairly. I think your characterization of McGovern's examples as fundamentals, quote-unquote, is more accurate than the oversimplifications, quote-unquote, as I had described them. I do think I was a bit hung up that he was trying to leverage a power-to-the-people attitude, quote-unquote, my personal fixation as explained below. I agree with you wholeheartedly that the Internet provides valuable additional information. However, there is also a lot of misinformation and gaming of the system going on. These days, it's certainly unpopular to criticize the widespread enthusiasm for the Internet's empowerment of, quote, the little guy, unquote. But often, the unauthorized, unfiltered sources with no apparent self-interest at stake are not as good as is perceived, while the authorized sources with a lot of self-interest at stake are not as, quote, evil, unquote, as is perceived. Recently, I tried to figure out how to put MP3 ringtones on my new phone. Knowing that AT&T wants me to buy them, I was searching for an unauthorized hack. I found lots of information. Most was wrong, and bashed Apple and iTunes a lot. But I ended up getting the correct info from Apple.com. Mostly, all those other sites were a lot of noise, and if I had not been kind of lucky, I wouldn't have figured it out. There's a book about this subject. It's called The Cult of the Amateur, and it is extremely unpopular and hated across the Internet. Oh my goodness. It has its shortcomings, but I think the book is correct in describing a cult-like belief in unfiltered amateur information. The advertising industry has been using this technique for a long time. Man-on-the-street interviews for cough drops, the Snapple lady, and now we have Tay Zonde advertising Dr. Pepper through Dig.com. Didn't mean to go nuts on the topic, but I told you it's a bit of a personal fixation. Well, thanks for your notes, Eric. We always appreciate those. And now we have a note from Apo in Finland, it looks like, if I'm reading the domain correctly. And I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Apo. Hello, I'm a new listener and have been listening to the old podcasts. I'm just listening to the Cyclometer podcast from 2 years ago. I was looking for the image of the cyclometer mentioned in the podcast, but it seemed not to be available. And Apo is right. I it took me a long time to get those pictures, and then I forgot to put them up. So thank you so much for bringing that to my attention.
Oppo also says, another comment. I think it is highly unintuitive to have the link to the current page link to itself. I got confused. Didn't I just get to that page for that episode? Why do I have to click again? And when clicking, of course, the same page reopens. By the way, great show, especially the one where you discussed packaging. Very, very interesting. Well, Oppo is right yet again. It's not good practice, I'm sure we all know this, to link something to itself so that the same page in the same spot opens up. It's very confusing. And that is the template that Libsyn, the hosting service I use for this podcast, gave me. And I don't know enough HTML or CSS to really fix that yet. I think it's a challenge that I look forward to learning more about. But it always seems that when I want to spruce up the blog page to make that template better, or maybe find a new template altogether, it's, you know, by the time I've researched a show, recorded the episode, edited the episode, done the photographs for it, put it up, I don't have much time to tweak the homepage or the blog page, and I wish I did. If anybody has any suggestions, you're always welcome to send them at designcritique@gmail.com, including HTML code samples or CSS things. But yes, I'd prefer that the template was not as unusable as it sometimes is. And maybe in 2008 I can do something about that. And Oppo also had another thing here I thought it was quite interesting. Here's a compliment. I really like your longitudinal approach of evaluating user experience. It is often that important aspects only come about with longer experience with a product, particularly when using it in real life instead of just playing around with it. One more thing that I like about your show. Many other design-related podcasts start with almost a minute-long intro, which I always skip. Your intro is brief and quick, but it still works. That is, lets me know what this show is about. By the way, I work as a usability specialist at, I better not say the name in case Oppo doesn't have permission to talk about the company, at an elevator company, the fourth largest elevator and escalator company in the world. I focus on the user experience of the elevator, as well as the usability of a bunch of internal websites and applications. Although it might seem a bit shallow, I'd love to hear an episode about elevator user experiences. Give it a thought the next time you take the elevator. Well, Oppo, this is brilliant. I was just on an elevator that I was not very happy with a week or so ago. I had the misfortune to be in a hospital from some testing, and there was an elevator that the original floors for this two-story building were the ground floor and the first floor. And the elevator buttons had been G for ground and 1 for the first floor, which was really the top floor. So anyway, it looked like the staff of this building had decided they didn't want ground floor, 1 floor. They wanted first floor, second floor. So they had taken a Sharpie marker, and I'm not making this up, they'd taken a Sharpie marker and written on the elevator control panel next to the original buttons what the new numbers should be, 1 and 2. So not only did this look bad, but it looked to me, and I could be wrong, I hope I am, but it looked to me as if the Braille numbering had not been changed. The little pieces of Braille that were put beneath the original elevator buttons for all the buttons, the ones below the floors had the same patina as the other ones. It didn't look like they'd put new Braille numbers up to reflect the 1 and 2 instead of G and 1. So I thought, man, that stinks. If you're blind and you're trying to get to the first and second floors, but the elevator is using G and 1 still, that's a huge accessibility problem, and it's rude. It's rude. It's downright mean, actually, I would say. And the elevator itself was not very pleasant, and boy, I've been on a lot of elevators, and I think about this sometimes. So, Oppo, it's not shallow at all. I will try to put together an episode on elevators later this year, and perhaps I will invite you to participate, because what better person to have than someone who works in this field, talking about the elevators. So, thank you for that feedback. One last note here, and then we're done. This is from Gregor, and this is from Austria, I believe. AT, that's Austria domain. Dear Tim and Tom, I really enjoy listening to your podcasts and would like to cite one of them for a paper for the University of Technology, Vienna, Austria. But I couldn't find either one of your guys' full names at your homepage. Mind to help me out? So, yes, it's Timothy Kiernan and Tom Brink. And we didn't want to put our names or much about ourselves on the blog page at all. We just wanted the episodes and their content to speak for themselves. And so you will find our full names in the MP3 metadata fields for composer. I believe that's where we put our full names on each episode. So you could find them there, but it's not an obvious place to look. We're being subtle. So, speaking of feedback, and thanks to everyone who wrote in, if you'd like to send some feedback to the show, either about this episode with Kim Goodwin or any of the prior episodes in the archive, please send me a note at designcritique@gmail.com. That's designcritique@gmail.com. And until the next episode, thanks for listening.